like we have everybody. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
That's gone.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The second row on the back up there, please come down and sit in the front. If you need me to point out who is the second row, I will do so. Not, no, you're not the second row. You sit down. I'm talking about the turkeys that are hiding. Is there nobody else? I thought there were three. There's somebody else in there. Yeah, you. Well, what do you think I meant? Oh, I'm really sorry. Well, next time I will make sure that you can sit in the front row the whole time. Okay? Because it's really fun to be in the front. You get to harass me. No. I have to be very careful about that. May I make sure that everybody understands the gig? Papers will be due no later than 5 o'clock on the 16th of December. That is Friday the 16th. Anybody later than that, I cannot guarantee that I will read them or grade them on time. In other words, you may have an incomplete for the term. If you don't worry about those kinds of things, it's cool with me. People at Princeton still don't have their grades. I've got 4 papers from my Princeton class last spring, and you know, I told them I'd get to it before the start of the next semester. So I can assure you, your papers will be read before the start of the fall semester next year. So my feeling is that you ought to get them in by the 16th.
How are those being submitted?
How are they being submitted? They're being submitted on white 8.5 by 11 paper.
No, I mean, who do you give them to?
Who do you give them to? Well, there's Tate. There's Neil.
We'll set up a box. Yeah, just like your structures box.
The portfolios will do the same day. This will come to New York in 3 or 4 huge cartons, right? It takes quite a bit of time to go through. I would advise you all, do not make it difficult for me to look at your portfolio. I don't want your drawings from your paper in your portfolio. That is a real, what I would call, a pain in the ass to have to turn over pages and turn over the big pages of the portfolio. I say it because no matter how many times I say it, there are always one or two people that do that, right? I will not look at any drawings that are not together with the paper. Is that clear?
Do you prefer to have it integrated in the text or out?
I prefer to have it integrated.
Okay.
Because can I tell you something?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know how, the worst thing that I have to do at this institution is to read your papers, right? No matter how wonderful you may think they are, doing 50 of them, thank you, Zara. If doing 50 takes me 50 hours, let's say, by the time I look at the drawings and read, I mean, you know, and mark them and blah, 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 it's awful. It's not what I call fun. So try and think, what would be easy? It's like when you apply to Yale and you do a portfolio, you try and put your good drawings in the front because if you put them in the back, nobody will ever get to them. I mean, when they go over portfolios, it's just, or for a jury or anything. It's a way of presenting yourself. So, make sure that the typing is double-spaced, please. It's really hard to read and make comments when it's not double spaced. Any other questions? And these are two. There's just a standard black 11 by 17, you know, and you put them in, right? It's.
And make sure that any drawings that are hand drawn or half hand drawn on them, that you scan them before you give them to us. Just for your portfolio. Hopefully nothing gets lost, but there is always a chance.
No, nothing gets lost.
Nothing gets lost.
We have a special treat today in that Dean Stern is going to spend a half hour reviewing your drawings. I think they were warned of that. I hope we have some good drawings. Yay or nay?
Some.
Well, he's expecting wonders, so who knows? So he will be here today. I want to make sure. Next week, we're doing Moretti. I would certainly read my text, and I would certainly read Rainer Banham's text on the Casa Girasole. And I think this would be really a very useful. Those two texts will really help you with your analysis. Any questions about the world? No. Let me think if I've missed anything. No, I have a special presentation to make when Neil gets back, but you notice he's absent for a very good reason, that he doesn't want to be around for this presentation. He took advantage of me last week, and I gave him 34 points on a football game. Any of you know about football betting? Giving 34 points to somebody is like handing them money. You don't do that. But of course, those people that are greedy often pay a price, and Neil is paying that price. Now, of course, I don't even want to talk about this guy's team. Gone into the toilet this year, never to appear again, right? So my assistants are being very quiet after starting the year with all the hoo-ha-ha. But that's neither here nor there. You still have a band, yes. Only there are no points for band. Okay. Taranyi, I think that Giuseppe Taranyi is one of the sort of, like Adolf Loos, one of the important minor figures. Excuse me. I got to put mine there because this is useless. You know, you'll never get this. Where's my bag? I left it upstairs. Screw it. No. We'll use this tech, this thing. I knew I forgot something. Taranyi represents a very interesting moment in modern architecture in that he comes out of a Italian historical tradition not out of the Le Corbusier tradition, so that what we're looking at is somebody who is neither Adolf Loos and what Loos represented, nor is he Le Corbusier, nor is he Mies van der Rohe. He doesn't come out of the Cubist painterly tradition, but an Italian modernist tradition that is very unique. Now, the reason why I say that is that Italian modern architecture begins probably around 1922, with Mussolini's march on Rome. And most of the Italian architects were part of the fascist movement. We have to put that into context because there's an enormous difference between Italian fascism, admittedly a movement of the right, and Nazism in Germany. Italian fascism was very much interested in architecture and supported modern architecture throughout the regime up until 1938, as a matter of fact. And of course, in 1938, the racial laws went into effect in Germany and in Italy, and Hitler insisted that there be these laws. Now, many of the modern architects in Italy happened to have been Jewish. They were also members of the fascist party. In fact, Mussolini's mistress, Margherita Sarfatti, was a Jewess. She also happened to be Taragni's patron, or patroness. And Taragni received many potential commissions through her relationship with Mussolini. He did the monument to her son, Roberto Sarfatti, who died in the First World War, he had done a series of monuments which are, I think, quite interesting, notably among them the Santa Lia monument in Como. Taragni's brother was an engineer, was also mayor of Como, and Taragni has a very interesting history because he was given a commission to do a housing block in 1929 when he was only, he was born in 04, he was 25 years old, very young. But this was a time when young architects could get work, and many young Italian architects did have work. His project is very interesting because it's a model for the way he did the Casa del Fascio, is that he proposed a very modest 19th century sort of Victorian classical apartment house, indistinguishable from anything of the 19th century that you might find in northern Italy. This classical apartment house was approved by the Planning Commission and was only discovered as the building went up that, in fact, that was a ruse to get planning permission, and in fact Taragni produced a very modern, almost Russian constructivist building. There was a great brouhaha about this, but what's so amazing is that the same trick worked with the Casa del Fascio. He produced a rather Victorian, modest building for the Casa del Fascio first, and then produced this quite elegant modern building. Taragni was, in fact, on his way to several really important commissions. And why I say that Italian fascism was different than... I don't have my tape with me. Is this going to be all right?
Yeah, I'll see if I can do the same process to get it transferred onto the tape.
Yeah, I left it upstairs. That's what I mean. And there's no reason to go and get it. In 1933, Le Corbusier wrote, our very own Le Corbusier, they wrote to Mussolini saying that he wanted to work for the Italian regime. And at the time, the French and the English were courting the Italians to try and get the Italians to join with the French and English against the Nazis. There were moments of hesitation, and of course, one doesn't know what the outcome would have been if Italy, in fact, had joined France and England. In any case, Mussolini invited Corbu to come to Rome, and he gave two lectures. which were published in Italian, which have never been published, as a matter of fact, in English, trying to get them published because they're very interesting, on the relationship of architecture to town planning. So, as late as 33, Corbu was in Rome as a guest of Mussolini, trying to get work in Italy. In 38, Mussolini, at the same time that the racial laws went in, Mussolini decided to build a new Rome called Terza Roma, which was Third Rome. He saw, he changed the Roman calendar so that when they occupied Rome, they started with Anno Uno in 1922. So by 38, we were in Anno Diciassette, and they were wanting to make a world's fair. It's now called EUR, when it was the Esposizione Universale Roma, and Taragni was given several major buildings in the EUR to design. He was also given a major sort of reception building for the fascist regime near the Colosseum in Rome, which he was also working on. He was doing the competition. He had won the competition for the Brera Museum in Milano, and he had five or six major commissions. Now, what's interesting is that Mussolini was really not interested in going to war. He knew he didn't have an army. In fact, many of the parades of Mussolini's army were parades of people in cardboard tanks marching. You can see their feet, and these things look like tanks, only they're really dummies. Mussolini was more interested in doing his city, his Third Rome, than he was in fighting war, as the Nazis quickly found out. What happened was is that it was still possible in Italy to send a substitute to the war. And in 39, Taragni was called up. He had been a captain in the artillery, and he wrote a letter to Mussolini. I've seen the correspondence saying that he wanted to stay and work, and Mussolini wrote back and said if he could find an acceptable substitute, that is, pay somebody to go in his place, he could continue to work on these major commissions that he had. Something went wrong, and he couldn't find, I guess, or didn't find a substitute, and he went to the Russian front. Let's see, he was now 35, he went with the Italian Blue Division. Now, there's an interesting history of the Italian Blue Division plays an important role in the turning point in the war, because the German offensive, which had in the winter of 41-42 had stalled outside of Moscow, decided to go south toward Stalingrad in the winter of 42-43. And the epic and decisive battle of the war, which turned the tide on the Russian front, happened in the November, December, and January of 42-43. This was when General von Paulus's German 6th Panzer Army attacked frontally the Russians in Stalingrad, and there was street hand-to-hand fighting, etc. And the history has been recorded. But what the Germans did and made an enormous mistake is on their right flank, that is their left flank, their northern flank, they placed the Hungarian 1st and the Italian Blue Division, as they didn't want them in the street fighting because they knew they weren't very good. They want them protecting the flank. Now the Russians found out about this, and they drew von Paulus's main force, which was 250,000 men, which was a big number, into Stalingrad, and they held in reserve their own major forces, which attacked at the north through the Italian Blue and the Hungarian 1st, and surrounded von Paulus's army. And this was a huge defeat in terms of morale and propaganda for Hitler, and this was really the beginning of the end of the war. What it has to do with our story is that Taranyi, being a really an extraordinary artist and intellectual, this was much too much for him, and the retreat from Stalingrad back through the Balkans was an enormously harrowing experience, and he recorded this in photographs drawings as he came back. When he returned to Italy in the spring of 43, he was by all accounts mentally disabled, is what you would call it. He was sent to an Italian military hospital in Cesenatico, which was on the coast, and his brother went to get him out of the hospital because he was the mayor of Como. He could do this, and a member of the party. So they brought this architect now in 1943 back to Como. He was now 39 years old. And he would wander the streets unable to deal with reality. And one day he died in, I believe it was June of 43, just before Badoglio surrendered in September of 43. This is all much more detailed than you need to know, but it's a sort of tragic story of a really incredible architect, and one doesn't know what he would have done after the war. What's also very interesting, and it's always it gives you this sort of Italian metaphysical component to anything. He had a protege called Cesare Cattaneo, who did a fantastic apartment building in Cernobbio, north of Como. And if you ever go to Como, you certainly should see the Cernobbio apartment building. This person was 29 years old. And the day after Taranyi died, the painter Mario Radice went to see Cattaneo and said to him that Taranyi had died and that he had said that we were wrong. In other words, that they had made a mistake about fascism. The next day, this young 29-year-old was dead. He expired. And of course, these are the kinds of things that happen, and nobody knows how or why, whether he committed suicide or what, but he was dead at 29. So two of the real bright lights of the Italian modern movement died in 43, and of course we know the tragic story. The Italians surrendered and the Germans moved into the north of Italy and set up the Salò Republic, which was one of the cruelest moments in where Italians were killing Italians. And this is where the Italian Communist Party got its start, because the Italian army didn't know what to do, and so rather than going over with the Germans, they joined the partisans. And a good friend of mine who is an architect, Carlo Imanino, who worked with Rossi, in fact, gave Rossi his housing project in Galla Ratese. Imanino was the son of the aide-de-camp of the King Victor Emmanuel. So he was raised in the palace in Rome in under the monarchy. He was in the Bersaglieri, and which is the elite Italian mountain division. And he was in northern Italy when Badoglio surrendered. And this royalist, let's say, or monarchist, had nothing to do but join the communists. And it was amazing because Carlo, after the war, became the head of the Communist Party in Venice and became mayor of Venice and etc. And so the political fortunes of movement from right to left were so scrambled that a person, the son of a household person in the monarchy could become a communist mayor. The story is important because we all look upon politics today as the divisions of left and right, and we look at somebody and say, oh, they're a fascist architect. There's an enormous difference between a fascist architect and somebody like Albert Speer, who was a very sinister character, even though a good architect. Now, Leon Krier and I often talk about this because he was very close to Speer and interviewed him in prison about his role as an architect. And I happen to be one of the best friends of Albert Speer's son, who also happens to be an architect. So one lives, in a sense, in this next generation, or I have lived through the sort of detritus of the war and much of what happened in modern architecture, that is, post 1945, and we're going to get to that next week when we get to Moretti, was conditioned by the 20 to 30 years prior to the war. And of course, modern architecture died in 1939. It was a hope for a social utopia, a political opening of the city, and what you have is the sort of chaos of war from 39 to 45, and then the rebuilding of Europe. I mean, Europe is where modern architecture began, and so one of the major characters in what I would call the first postmodern architect was a man by the name of Luigi Moretti. Now, Moretti was also a fascist architect. He had done several very important buildings in Rome prior to the war. And he was, there were a lot of ways that people who were former fascists and members of the party could be sort of sanitized after the war, because Italy and Germany couldn't have been run unless these people were enjoined to, as it were, change their spots. So Moretti became a member of the Christian Democratic Party and did quite a bit of work. His most famous project, which some of you may not remember because it's ancient history, was the Watergate apartment building in Washington, where the famous Nixon Haldeman Ehrlichman break-in was that caused Nixon to ultimately resign. That occurred at the Watergate apartments, and the Watergate apartments were done by Luigi Moretti, who we're going to be studying next week. So I'm taking you in a trajectory from Italy in 1922 all the way to the United States in 1975, where these characters play a very interesting role. Now, Torragni's Casa del Fascio, I think, is important because it talks about the relationship to history and how one deals with history. And so, and we were talking about this last night. I was having dinner with Mark Wigley, the Dean of Columbia, and Jeff Kipnis, both of whom are going to be on my review on the 8th, and I urge you all, if you can come to that review, I think you'll find it quite stimulating. We were talking about how generations open themselves up to dealing with their fathers. And of course, Mark was talking about, and Jeff were talking about, that I represented a father to their generation, and now we have the new generation of young people coming up who need not to kill me so much as to kill Wigley and Kipnis and how they deal with this. Well, Torragni had the same problem psychologically, and to understand in a very clear way what that problem was. So we get the Casa del Fascio, and who is Torragni's father, as it were, is Andrea Palladio. and the Palladian Villa was the type that still was in existence, even though it was in 19th century garb, as late as 1930. So what Tarangi does is to take the Palladian, and we're going to look at it in that context, takes the Palladian Villa and performs it in modern drag. And in doing so, what he does is to bring Palladio out onto a bridge, let's say, from the past to the present, and Tarangi, in a sense, blows that bridge up, and you have to be really careful when you're doing this sort of thing that you don't blow yourself up, any of you that want to become experts in demolition. Psychologically blows this bridge up and frees himself from a Palladio, so that the Casa del Fascio is a transition building, in a sense, for all of the young generation of Italian architects to free themselves from this extraordinary history. Now, you have to realize that we in America had nothing like the history that Italian architecture, whether it was Brunelleschi, Palladio, Bramante, Borromini, Piranesi, Rinaldi, you name it. I mean, there are many, many fathers. And to, in one building, to blow up that history, to free Italian architecture from that history is quite extraordinary. So that's one of the most important things about the Casa del Fascio. The second building that he does, that Tarangi does, that's important, is the Asilo Infantile, which is a totally, which you analyzed this week, is a totally modernist building. But it's a modernist building with a twist, because it isn't really a Pilotti building like Le Corbusier. It does not deal with the horizontal plane in the way that Corbu does. It doesn't deal with the column grids, as you will have noticed, the way Corbu does. It's a very anarchic building. In other words, it has modernist language. It's certainly not a classical building, but it has different axes, different fragments of pieces that are put together in a very radically different way than Cubist or Mises modernism, or even De Stael. The third building that Tarangi does, and I think it's important to understand, is that the Casa Giuliani Frigerio. This is a building that he designed in 1939, just as he was going off to the war. He never really saw it completed. It was completed by his assistant, Luigi Zuccoli. And for me, if you look at Giuliani Frigerio, you realize it's really the first postmodern building. It breaks with modernist canon, both in terms of modernist style, in terms of materiality, in terms of the relationship of the facade to the interior to its corners. There are all kinds of things happening in this building that are quite extraordinary for its time. In other words, it is a prefiguring of what is going to happen after the war, that is, the denial of modernism. And it's going to be prefigured in as a building that will influence Luigi Moretti's Casa Girasole. So Tarangi was well on his way to moving into a very radical and different world of architecture, probably much more different than even Le Corbusier was able to conceive of after the war, or Mies. It would have been really interesting to see where this career was going. And of course it gets cut short by the war. So he becomes a interesting and key figure. One of the most important issues about Tarangi that has to do with this building is that Paul Rudolph, in 1945, I guess, or 44, it might have been 44, when the war was still on. Rudolph was at Harvard. He wasn't in the service, and at the graduate school at Harvard. And Rudolph had Sartorius's book on the Hors de Climat de Méditerranée, and he was fascinated by Taragni. And he was the first person and the only person I know that ever looked at Taragni in the United States at that time. And there's no question in my mind that if we look at Paul Rudolph's early houses, the houses he did with Twitchell in Florida, just before this building here, they are very much Taragni inspired. They have that lightness of the Asilo, so it's really very interesting to see those Florida houses in relationship to the building that you looked at today. I mean, and Rudolph is part of the heritage of this place, but I think it's even more important to look at this building in relationship to the Giuliani Frigerio, the apartment building that he did just before he died. So I think there are really interesting connections between Rudolph and Taragni that are, I think, very important. And it, for me, I've always wanted to do an analysis of this building in relationship to the Giuliani Frigerio. Okay, that having been the giving you the background, we're going to go look at some pics. Are there any questions about the brief history of the world from 1922 to the present? Nothing.
Is there an event that you think caused Rudolph to change from looking at Taragni in the way he did with his apartment building and then designing this building the way he did?
Well, I think, first of all, moving from the South. Rudolph was raised in Alabama. He was a minister's son, I believe. Very devout, moral human being. He went to Auburn, I believe. He then from Auburn went to Harvard. And I think Harvard is where he finds Taragni. Okay, he wouldn't have found him in Auburn at the time. He goes to Florida to practice with this older man and start a practice. I encountered Paul first in 1952 at Cornell. He was a visiting critic in 52 while he was still living, before he became dean here. I don't know what happened or why it happened. There's no question that the Florida houses were dealing with a different climate, a different material effect than was possible in New Haven or in the North. So also one has to understand that, these internet connections are really interesting. My roommate at Columbia in 58 became Paul's number one right-hand person, John Fowler. He was a brilliant English architect, and he was a brutalist. He came out of Jim Sterling's school, and Jim was the first Davenport professor here that Paul brought over. And there's no question that Jim and Fowler and English brutalism and that really had an enormous impact on Paul. Whether this building and the how much Fowler had to do with this building, you just look at this concrete. This comes right out of England in the mid-50s. I mean, If you look at Jim's housing at Preston, if you look at his housing at Ham Common, and it comes out of the way Corbu treated concrete in the Maison Jaoux. I mean, the movement of Corbu away from abstract materiality to a kind of rough concrete, and you know, the vertical scoring, no one in their right mind would do that to concrete, because what it does is rips what is called the latency off the outside. In other words, it makes the concrete porous. So they poured this damn thing and then they chipped it away to cut the protection out of it, right? This was a wild thing to do. But to get that sort of rough patterned, in other words, people were looking for a tough patterned view to concrete that was not just poured in place and left on its own. So the way the formwork is in here, the way you see the result of the formwork, it all had to do with painters, you know, talking about the canvas and treating the canvas so that the canvas in painting in the 60s became part of the fabric of being, how the canvas was stretched, how it was treated, etc. This building is an ode to an index of how you use and treat material, how it's formed, how it's treated, etc. So a lot of that comes out of English brutalism, because brutalism was about the allowing the process of building to be recorded in the artifact of the building itself. I mean, that's what was happening in England, and it was very important. That's why you get Bannum in 1958, I think that text is, I mean, Bannum, who, if we were, let me just make sure the date of that text, 53. See, I'm really, he writes about the Casa Girasoli in 53. Bannum will write in 56 or 57 on an essay called New Brutalism, which is the thing that makes what Sterling and Smithson and these people were doing into a style, a condition of consciousness. And so very early on, there's a connection between Taranyi, Moretti, Bannum, Sterling, etc., all the way to Rudolph. The red line, the Fila Rosa, is very interesting, that brings you to this building. And the desire to bring back a certain idea of materiality and toughness to building. In other words, it was no longer abstract, it was real. And you get Italian realist cinema, you get realist painting, you know, it's no longer abstract and metaphysical. So this building is an icon of a moment in time where America, you know, with Kahn and Venturi, participated in a revolution, let's say, that was occurring in, particularly in England, and to a lesser extent in Italy. And this building is an important icon in that fact. So I think that when Rudolph leaves Florida and runs into the new brutes, that is Sterling and Bannum, etc., and John Fowler, the whole thing changes. And of course, Sterling changes when he runs into Leon Creer. I mean, Creer seduces Sterling away from this brutalist, you know, Creer hates this building, and he hates it because it represents to him a Sterling, as it were, that he was able to move away from brutalism to a true sort of pastiche postmodernism. And the building that Leon worked on with Sterling, the Derby Civic Center, is the icon of that moment of change when Sterling moves from this kind of modernist, realist modernist to a kind of true postmodern, historicized postmodernism. This is certainly, and of course, there's also, we got Frank Lloyd Wright hanging around in the background here. I mean, if you look at the plans of this building and you get a sense of Wright, a brutalist Wright, okay? So Paul was an important, I mean, I think Paul Rudolph is going to be recorded in history as a very important transition figure from a moment in time when there wasn't a consciousness of Europe to that kind of consciousness. Any other? Yeah.
Going back to the history a little bit, you said that, Jeremy, he said that fascism was wrong.
Yes.
Yeah. And it kind of killed him. But so at the beginning of the lecture, you kind of, it sounded like you were kind of justifying fascism in terms of its relationship with some Jewish people. And so I'm just wondering.
What I was saying is that Italian fascism was accepted by the Jewish population. Everybody thought, you know, to modernize Italy was very important. So there wasn't an anti-Semitic component to Italian fascism. Richard Rogers, who's going to be teaching here in the spring, you may not know Richard Rogers, but he's a work piano, and Rogers did the Centre Pompidou in Paris. You'll get to know who he is because he'll be here in the spring. His uncle was Ernesto Rogers, who was the editor of Casabella, the most important Italian magazine. And Rogers was a partner in the firm of BBPR, did most of the major Italian work in the post-war and pre-war. And they were Banfi Belgioso, who was a prince, Ludovico Belgioso. Banfi was Jewish, killed in Mauthausen. Belgioso, Perasuti, and Rogers. And Rogers escaped to Switzerland, but he was Jewish. And there's a picture of all four of them in black shirts, in other words, as members of the party. So there's a certain naivete to the Italian movement. I mean, certainly if you were of the left, you weren't welcome. If you were a communist, you wouldn't be happy in Italy from 22 to 33. But the Italian thing has a tragic moment to it because the Italians went around beating up the Ethiopians, the Abyssinians, the Eritreans. They wanted to have a new empire. And so they went and beat up these African countries and took them as colonies. That was their big problem. But as late as 38, before the racial laws went in, there were negotiations with the British and the French who wanted to bring the Italians in. And of course, let's not forget the role that the American and Italian mafia played in securing southern Italy, and especially the landings in Sicily. There were lots of play under the table with, you know, Italian mafia and trying to bring Sicily, which was always not really part of Italy. That's why they landed there. And the Sicilians couldn't wait for the Americans to come. They hated the Germans. The Italians have always hated the Germans because they treated them as lower class citizens. And so there was a kind of tragic time, and it could have been possible for Mussolini to have gone with England and France. Don't forget, if we go back in Italian history, and these things are important, Garibaldi, who liberated Italy from the Neapolitan Bourbons, the French and Spanish Bourbon kings, who were the kingdom of the two Sicilies, which was Palermo and Naples, and Garibaldi was the general for Cavour and Mazzini and the people from the north who gradually brought Italy into a single unity. Garibaldi's army was called Garibaldi and the Thousand, and they were in red shirts. Garibaldi bought his red shirts at Thresher and Glennie in the Strand, all right, in England. He went to England to get his red shirt. So, and of course, I mean, as an Italianophile, when I was in England, I went to Thresher and Glennie to buy my shirts, and it's still there, and pictures of Garibaldi. So there was an always Anglophile, Italianophile connection between Italy and England that was really very, very strong. On a lot of circles, Mussolini was seen as a good thing. Don't forget, we have a really, you have to look at the history of the 30s, not only in Europe, but here. The English aristocracy were threatened by one thing, not Mr. Hitler, not Mr. Mussolini, but communism, all right? And the Red Threat was very, very problematic. And in France, in Germany, not so much in Italy, but the enemy, and that's why Hitler occupied this very strange position early on, was communism. And, of course, communism was the big enemy here right through the 50s. All you have to do is go and see Good Night and Good Luck to understand what it was like here and how even the president of CBS would fire Murrow, even though he revealed the truth about Joe McCarthy and what was going on. It weren't so clear as it is looking back on it who were the good guys and who were the bad guys. Okay, it weren't so clear. It's not so clear that FDR was not an anti-Semite himself. I mean, not so clear. So, you know, the conditions in this country were not much different than in Germany at the time. I mean, the anti-Semitic prejudices were very strong and very clear. As were anti-Catholic. Forget blacks. I mean, blacks didn't exist in this country. I mean, they were, honestly didn't exist. I mean, I can remember going in the subway in New York City in 1941, walking into a subway car, and black people, if they were sitting, would stand when a white person got in and give them a seat. It was thought to be that's the way things were, right? We were not in my hometown allowed to swim in a public swimming pool because blacks would swim there. Whites didn't swim with blacks. I mean, I swam on a swimming team in a public high school. Blacks were not allowed to be on the team. I mean, it's just very, very clear prejudices which were dominant in this country, in the North as well as in the South. So when we look upon, what I'm saying is, when we look upon who are the good guys and bad guys in the world? We know that Hitler turned out to be a bad guy. We know that Mussolini turned out to be a bad guy. He happened to have a Jewish mistress, you know, for whatever that's worth. He was going to get her, though. I mean, she luckily got out. But in 38, she was done. But so there were the stories are very complicated. And hey, Bob Stern had dinner with George Bush the other night, okay? It's very complicated, right? It's really, really complicated, all right? So Bob Stern would have had dinner with Mussolini or Hitler if they would have been allowed. I doubt it, but what are we talking about, right? We have to be really careful about saying, and that's what I'm trying to do, the subtleties. I'm trying to point out the subtleties that exist. Do we know whether Pope Leo was a good guy or a bad guy? Do we know if Pope Julius was a good guy or a bad guy? We don't know those things. We know they supported Borromini. We know they supported Bramante. But do we know much about their... do we really care when we see the results? So what I'm saying is, you can call this a Casa del Fascio, built for the fascist party and gotten done because Tarani's brother was the mayor and the head of the fascist party, and that's how he got the job. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? When I arrived in Italy in 1960 to see this building, summer of 61, I should say, it wasn't called the Casa del Fascio. It was called the Casa del Popolo, House of the People, because it had been taken over, and now we had a left-wing, almost red government in Como in the time. And you couldn't speak of Tarani. In other words, this and fascism was impossible. And so my work on Tarani was sort of done in a certain obscurity because nobody wanted to talk about it. Couldn't. It was not possible. This was in 1961-62. Gradually, when the Marxists, the first were the Marxists who started studying fascism, because dialectically it was important to the Marxists in Italy to do this. And Tafuri, who's a Marxist, was, you know, one of the most important of those critics. The person who's coming on my jury on the 8th from Italy, Piero Vittorio Orelli, is an ardent Catholic and a Marxist, you know. And these things are all part of the makeup of strange makeups. I mean, you say, how can you be an ardent Catholic, go to Mass every day, let's say, and be a Marxist? These kinds of complexities are very important to understand. This, things aren't black and white. They're subtle shades. And I think that the political, I mean, what was Corbu? Corbu had a magazine called Prelude in 35, run by a known fascist. His partner was a known fascist. And Prelude was about prelude to war. And there are several Corbu articles praising the idea of war and going to war and joining the Germans in war. All right, this is Le Corbusier, right? This stuff is kept under wraps. You know, you don't even hear about this magazine Prelude. But I know about it, right? And straight histories want to keep things clean, right? They don't want to get it dirty at all. And so Corbu is this social radical, you know, that did social housing, etc. But his connections to the right are very problematic. As, I mean, take many French intellectuals, Maurice Blanchot, one of the most noted French intellectual, had very strong connections to the radical right. And Paul Demain, the famous Yale professor of deconstruction, the father in the sense of Jacques Derrida, wrote for Nazi newspapers in Belgium in 40, 41, etc. So we have to be really careful about drawing this guy's a fascist, therefore he's a bad guy. Peter Eisenman, right, sitting here. Who is my biggest client? Right? My biggest client is a man called Manuel Fraga Iribarne. Who is Manuel Fraga Iribarne? Well, he is the last living minister of Francisco Franco's fascist regime in Spain. Okay? He is, I mean, so... what are we talking about, right? I mean, how close you want me to get, right? So he is also the father, Fraga Iribarne is also the founder of the Partito Popolare, which is the sanitized version of Franco's party, okay? And what did he do? He promoted Aznar. And Aznar, who was the president of Spain until they lost because of this bombing, M11, they were the descendants of Franco's party. So, politically, hey, who supports my work in Ohio? The Republican Party, as conservative as it can be. Who supports my work in Arizona? The Republican Party, as conservative as it can be. Who supported my memorial? Helmut Kohl, as conservative as can be. So you can look at me and say, how can I say anything about Bob Stern going to have dinner with George Bush, right? You can say that I'm tainted because I work for conservative, right-wing political entities, right? I'm a sitting example, and that's why I find these issues very complex. If I was invited to go have dinner with George Bush, I mean, I can tell you, on my honeymoon, and it, by the way, story, this is, on my second honeymoon, to my second wife, where did we go? We spent it in a motel in Clemson, South Carolina. Why? Because I was the guest of the future president of Clemson University, who happens to be an architect, in his box for the Clemson, South Carolina football game. Okay? Mama, think about my wife, right? I mean, this is really something. So we're up in the box, and I'm announced as this noted architect from New York who's here as the guest of the, and J. Strom Thurmond. I won't tell you the whole story because it's too problematic in this context. But J. Strom Thurmond says, I want to meet that boy, that New York boy. So my host brings J. Strom over and his beauty queen wife of 30 years old or something like that, you know, gorgeous. So he says to my wife, who was pregnant, he said, Sonny, that's a good-looking piece of woman you got there, right? I mean, to my wife, right? And I said, yes, sir. He said, how old are you, Sonny? And he called me. And I said something. And I said, you know, Senator, I have to tell you something. I don't really agree with your opinions, but I certainly admire your straightforwardness. And that's about all I could say to him. And it was true. Because, I mean, the guy was, off the charts. But he was some character. And he made quite an impression on my wife and myself on this particular occasion. One meets these kinds of people, in one's encounters in life. So, any other questions? Okay, so now we've got the political condition of the world is very complicated, all right? From Bob Stern to Peter Eisenman to anybody in this room, you'll find out. It's not so clear, right? And you might consider yourself somebody of the left. Look, I voted for Eisenhower twice, all right? I don't consider myself a Republican. I wouldn't vote for Michael Bloomberg because he happened to be a Republican. I didn't vote. I said, I don't want to do this in this particular moment in time. But there was a time in my life when I voted straight Republican. I now vote straight Democratic, even though I work for right-wing people. So go figure. Right? It ain't clear. Right? If someone said to me, if the new Pope said, hey, Peter, and I entered a competition for doing a Catholic church, the new Pope has got to be as right as the recent popes are. He said, Peter, I want you to do, I love your architecture, and I love what you did in Germany, and he's a German. I'd love you to do a new church for me. Would I say no? I don't agree with your philosophy. I'd be there, tomorrow, okay, with bells on, right? Bobbing and weaving if I had to, right? So you can say I have no morality, no political consciousness. That's not true. I think these things are very different. I don't live in an apartment designed by myself. I don't believe that my art, that is my architecture, I have to live in. I wouldn't want anybody to live in what I do. Look at this thing. Yet it's a great piece of work. I believe that I can do great work and still have a life that is different from the work. And I believe that's really important to understand, that you don't have to live your work. You have to love your work, you don't have to live it. And I think those are very important distinctions, especially when we come to political things. Okay, let's look at these pics. And when the little monster comes, we'll move next door. He reads all the tapes, so you know. Don't worry, he hears everything. We don't exercise. Okay, this is a building. I think you ought to go and see. You know, in these many trips that you're going to take, what's important about this building to me is the fact that it's a palazzo. It has two bays, three bays. Two bays, A, B, A, but it's an asymmetrical ABA. So you have what is called a solid block over here and a cage. So it's an asymmetrical solid cage relationship. Now what's interesting about the cage is it is not piloti, and there's very clearly a horizontal cord across here which makes this a plane. In other words, and it's a plane made up of vertical and horizontal elements of the same size, so that you have a grid. Now, what's interesting about that grid is it talks about two conditions of architectural thinking that is purely architectural, and that is called, we've talked about centrifugal and centripetal. Centrifugal, we've talked about the ground plane, the five points of architecture. Here, Tarani's talking about something called additive and subtractive. In other words, if you have architecture which forms space, it can form space in two ways. You can think like Michelangelo said that the figure is in the stone, and you chip away the stone to reveal the David. So you can look at the Casa del Fascio and say these voids here are chipped out of a solid to reveal the void. So here, in this case, the void becomes positive and part of a subtractive process. Now this is really important to get, okay? So you chip away from this solid as a purposeful gesture to produce a square void. So therefore the void is not minus, it's positive. It has the positive vector, and the columns become, as it were, the negative vector. They are the residue of a subtractive process. Now you can read the facade in another way, and that is as an additive, that you have a series of sticks and you put them together to form a grid plane, as you have in the Palazzo, in the Cortile at Urbino, which we talked about. And then you see the process as additive. In other words, there is no pre-existing solid. The process is additive, and then the voids become negative. They are the residue of the additive process. They are not intentional. They are what happens when you put the sticks together. So here we have what I would call an internal architectural dialectic, one between an additive and subtractive process, and the other where the void can be read as plus or minus, so that solid is not always plus in architecture, a plus valence, and void is not only a negative valence. It can have a positive valence. This is what turns architecture from purely a physical construct to what I would call a text. In other words, you have to interpret this in the ways that I've said, because it's not just a grid with some windows behind and offices. Because you will note, by the way, that all of these facades have a relationship. There is a rotational relationship, and we'll talk about that. In addition to additive and subtractive, we have a condition called rotation and stasis. And this is set up because you see there is a wall plane behind here, which is like this wall plane, which is set back. So you get the idea that the left-hand side has been pushed back and the right-hand side has come forward, creating a rotational, conceptual rotational condition. That's important, and you'll see it in the drawings. In other words, when you look at Taranyi's drawings, you will see the intentionality of all of these, what I call textual conditions. Next, please. You can see from this is the that ground plane, the horizontal and vertical pieces. This is an empty void in the center here, and this is a plane. You can see this marking over here of this plane, which is set back. You get over here, you can see the void on the ground floor and the void up above, and the fact that this is an H shape. You can see the H. Part of the H are these windows that are set in the plane, and this solid here. Next, please. Here is what the building looked like in the 30s, before the railroad was put in. There's a railroad that runs in front of it now to the main station. Here is the back of the building, and it relates to the transepts of the cathedral. There's a vector, an axis that comes off the what would be the right transept through the central axis of the Casa del Fascio. There was another building, another block planned to be on the other side. It is precisely, and this is where, again, the idea of the building as a text comes in. It is precisely a half cube in its dimensions. Next, please. You can see an early drawing of Taranyi that there was an entry to be in the blank wall, which was later decided against this. I've studied, there were hundreds of his sketches for this project, and this was one. You begin to see how the windows are set into this plane. We'll talk about that. Next, please. Now, here is a picture of a building in Brno in Czechoslovakia, done by an architect called Muschenheim, that clearly influenced Taranyi, but gets all of the elements wrong. Okay? First of all, the grid of columns and horizontals is not coplanar, so that the horizontals here are set back. So that's number one. The top edge is also has a cap to it, which is thicker than the rest, so that it's not just a plane that's additive and subtractive. It has a heavier coursing here at the piano nobile, so that these columns begin to look like piloti. So the message is not clear. Is this a Pilote building? It is a planar building. Is it a classical building with a cornice line on the top? That's number one. Number two, the frontal plane is not clear because the piece here, which is set back from this piece, is equally as big in its dimension as the front plane. So there is no, as it were, picture plane or vertical datum from front to which to read anything. The really key problem in this project is that you enter along the side. You don't enter through this entry box here from the front. You slide in between the two. So all of the things, this looks to be a prototype for Tirani's building, and indeed it was in his office. I found this picture in the office, and he clearly was influenced by it. But it makes all of the architectural mistakes. In other words, there are no critical elements here. They're merely stylistic. And therefore, this does not form a critical text as opposed to the Tirani building. Now, let's look at this corner, because we talked about rotation. And also the idea now, another dialectical category, not only of solid and void, but solid and plane. If you look at this, it looks like a Palladian four-corner tower palazzo. And you have solid, void, and of course I said this plane is set back over here. But what makes the rotation really clear is look at this corner. All right? It isn't solid. It's two planes. This plane is set back from the corner, as revealed here, so that this is out, in, out, in. So you have, not only do you have a breakdown of the solid as a corner into planes, but you have the rotational condition now on two sides. That is out, in, and so therefore both sides, this rotation starts. This is a key condition, and you've got to be able to understand the importance of Tirani drawing that to understanding the actual building. The kinds of things that I want you to get used to doing and understanding and realizing that they become important to making what I would consider to be critical architectural gestures. Okay, next please. Now what's interesting also in his drawings is that he was talking about, as it were, a solid within a solid. That is a outside container and an inside element. And he draws this thing in two ways. First of all, he draws it as a solid, as a white frame with a black solid inside. Here's that door that disappears in the facade. But then when you go to the back, you realize that there is that solid set back. If you see this element is set back, the horizontal line goes across here. And continues across here so that you can read this piece as a solid setback. But because it's now white, it makes it much more, as it were, dialectical. It's much more subtle than just painting the block black. So Tirani opted for this white on white. In other words, the white solid within the white shell, as opposed to the black solid in the white shell. These drawings are really important to look at because you can see the process of the work. I want you to notice the window on the rear facade over here and how they're going to change. Here, they were merely punctures in into the solid wall. Next, please. Okay. Now, take it one further. I just want to see something. Go back. Okay. Now, this is the way the building was built. You can see still that horizontal line coming across, which frames the white solid behind. But I want you to notice this window. And this is one of the most important gestures in all of modern architecture, I believe. This is the only window that punctures the solid. So, and it is framed, it's not cut into the solid, it punctures through the plane. So it either suggests that the glass, which is treated as a crystalline condition, in other words, as a solid, is stronger than conceptually the wall that it punctures. So it turns this wall into a thin layer which is punctured by the glass. So we have now the glass puncturing the solid. And I'm sorry, I don't have the picture that I want to have, but if you look and study the plans, and this is where it becomes a truly conceptual work. The building is, for all intents and purposes, a half cube. And you can feel it as a half cube when you walk around it and see it. If I were to ask you all, you know it's not a whole cube, a half cube. However, when you measure the drawings, you will find that this dimension from front to back is shorter than the dimension from side to side. And the only way that it becomes a cube in its actual dimensions, not its seen dimensions, is when this punctures the wall, number one. And then, if you notice, all the windows pivot at an angle or open, they're all pivoting. The windows here, and there's one pane that opens vertically. It's the only window in the building that's not open here, but I have pictures of it, that pushes out vertically, so it becomes a plane. So we have a plane of concrete, we have a plane of glass, and then we have a further plane of glass, vertical plane. When that plane is extended out, the dimension becomes an actual cube. And that's an extraordinary moment. So that what you are witnessing is the fact that only as the something which seems to go outside of the cube completes the actual cubic dimension. And you know, that takes a certain kind of monster operating to do that sort of thing. To me, those are the kinds of things that one needs to be aware of when one is understanding what it takes to make a canonical building. This is a canonical building with a canonical gesture. And unique, as far as I'm concerned, in the history of modern architecture. Okay, next, please. Still don't have, there you can see the projection of this window out and the projection out. You see the band, the horizontal banding coming across, and this, you can see this piece of solid set back from the frame so that you can read the notion of these different conditions of solid, frame, puncture, etc., all of which deal with the possibility of architecture to be. Next, please. This is the most solid facade, and again, what's interesting about it is that the windows are behind, that is, they are in the plane of this interior solid, and you get this kind of depth of the facade where the rear facade seemed to be thin, this facade seems to be thick. until you get over here. Remember where that, this is where that drawing showed the panel set back, and here you have a setback corner, but it's a reverse because the most glass is here and the most solid is here. So again, while it's a corner and it's a panel set back, it's set back as it were a void, as opposed to this, which is a solid with holes punched into it. Here is a stick building. So the corner here is stick, while the rest of it is solid and punched holes. Next, please. And you can see this corner. That's these. This is these windows over here. You can see the normal, as it were, window tilting up rather than. Then the only projection of a window as straight is the one in the rear. Next. These are some of the interiors with Tarani's use of glass block, both sometimes as solid and sometimes as void. Next. One of the most amazing pieces of work in terms of transition is this set of doors. First of all, let's talk about this idea of transition, which is again important. There is in Japanese architecture a style of architecture called Sukiya style, which is the tea house style. And in the tea house style, there is a relationship between that which is man-made and that which is natural. And it allows for a transition from inside to outside. I describe that this in my book on Tarani, but Tarani picks up on this Sukiya transition. What you get is the pavement and the floor slab here, but you're outside. There's another projection over here on the, you can just see it in this picture, which is the inside coming out. And then the doors, which are a permeable membrane, as it were, which allows you to go inside, but you haven't yet got inside because you're still in this entry bay. So you're between inside and outside, and it's only when you pass these columns do you get, that is, in here, inside. Now what's interesting, there are, I believe, 18 doors all on a mechanism that allow them to spring open at the same time. And of course, the young black shirts would march out through the doors into the plaza. But they have both a political and an architectural connotation. It's the most amazing set of doors I've ever seen. It's this plane here, and then one button, and they spring open. Next. The interiors are some of the most immaculately done in terms of their relationship to the tectonic strategies of the outside. Again, I go over this in my book in much greater detail, which I think is interesting only from the obsessive quality that I show in detailing this building. Next. Another important condition relating to the outside is, when is glass void? When is it solid? When is it minus, and when is it plus? If we take this wall, this plaster wall, as a datum, I want you to look at the glass block. Here, the glass block on this side is projective and therefore reads as a solid. Here's the same glass block, which is recessive and therefore reads as a void. So here's two conditions where this is a fulcrum between void, minus, and solid plus, and it's the same material. Now, if you can do those kinds of things with material, you're really operating in an incredible way in architecture. And this is, again, the same kinds of issues, and this, you know, this is not a functional consideration. This wall could have been brought out to here, or this wall could have been pushed back. But he wanted to make, to use glass block as both solid and void. I want you to notice this handrail, one of the great handrails of all time, which is both metal and glass. and look at the indentation, the relationship of the outside windows to cuts on them in the material on the inside, revealing the thickness of the marble. It's quite extraordinary, the relationship of three-dimensional inside and outside. Next, please. That's it. Now, I didn't want you to analyze this building because I've analyzed it to death in my book, and you know I didn't want any sort of copycat analysis. And I did analyze the Giuliani Frigerio in my book, but I didn't do the Asilo Infantile. So it's going to be really interesting because I think the Asilo is one of the difficult buildings of Turani's to understand. And of course, we always look at these things after the fact, so we'll have a see. So why don't we take 10 minutes and then we'll go next door.